Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Implied Right of Action Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Wednesday, January 21st, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Fitzgerald v. Barnstable School Committee. In this case, the Supreme Court considered whether Title IX's implied right of action precludes Section 1983 claims to remedy sex discrimination by federally funded educational institutions. In a unanimous decision, the court held that Title IX does not preclude such Section 1983 claims, and therefore remanded the case for further proceedings. To discuss the decision, we welcome Vanderbilt University Law School Professor Brian Fitzpatrick. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Fitzpatrick.
On January 21st of this year, the Supreme Court decided Fitzgerald v. Barnstable School Committee. The question presented in this case was whether plaintiffs who seek to bring suits for sex discrimination against institutions that receive federal funds have only one congressionally provided cause of action for sex discrimination, or whether they have two congressionally provided causes of action. The case arose out of allegations of student-on-student sexual harassment at a public school in Barnstable, Massachusetts. One student, the kindergarten daughter of the plaintiffs in the case, alleged that a third-grade student bullied her into undressing while she rode the school bus to and from school. The plaintiffs brought complaints of the harassment to Barnstable school officials, but the plaintiffs contend the school failed to respond adequately to their complaints. They brought a suit for sex discrimination under both 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 and Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 is a Reconstruction-era statute that provides a general cause of action for the deprivation of constitutional rights. The plaintiffs allege the school system violated the Equal Protection Clause and thereby Section 1983 when it failed to respond adequately to their complaints of sexual harassment. The plaintiffs allege that the school district likewise violated Title IX when it failed to adequately respond to their complaints of the sexual harassment. Title IX prohibits sex discrimination by institutions like the school system in Barnstable that receive federal funds. The Federal District Court in Massachusetts dismissed the Section 1983 claim on the ground that when Congress created the Title IX right of action in 1972, it implicitly displaced the 1983 cause of action. The United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit in Boston affirmed the district court's ruling on this question, and the Supreme Court accepted certiorari to decide whether Congress's creation of the private right of action for sex discrimination under Title IX implicitly displaced the more general cause of action created 100 years earlier for the deprivation of constitutional rights. By unanimous vote, the court held that Title IX does not displace 1983 actions, and it reversed the First Circuit. The first question that comes to everyone's mind when they learn of the issue in this case is, what difference does it make whether plaintiffs can sue for sex discrimination under 1983, under Title IX, or under both statutes? The answer is that in some instances, Title IX sweeps more broadly than Section 1983, and in some instances, Section 1983 sweeps more broadly than Title IX. Thus, if only one cause of action existed, some suits and some remedies would not be available that would be available under the other cause of action. For example, under Title IX, only institutions can be sued, institutions that receive the federal money. Under 1983, by contrast, both institutions and the individuals that work for them can be sued. This difference is particularly important in this case because the plaintiffs have sued not only the school system, but also the superintendent of the school system. The suit against the superintendent might not be cognizable under Title IX, even though it might be under 1983. The court cited these differences between 1983 causes of action and Title IX causes of action in its decision holding that Title IX did not displace the Section 1983 action. The court began its analysis by noting that, as in past cases, the critical question was what Congress intended. Did it want one cause of action or two? The court noted that because Section 1983 sometimes sweeps more broadly, and because Title IX sometimes sweeps more broadly, it was most likely that Congress wanted both actions to coexist. This was especially the case, the court said, because unlike in past cases where it has found Section 1983 actions displaced by more recent enactments, there were no special procedural hoops that Congress implemented along with the Title IX cause of action. There were no special procedural hoops that could be easily circumvented by bringing a 1983 suit instead. The court just did not see how permitting plaintiffs to bring suit under Section 1983 would frustrate some kind of special congressional design for Title IX. Indeed, the court noted that Congress appeared to assume that Section 1983 actions would continue after it enacted Title IX. At the same time it enacted Title IX, it amended another provision in the U.S. Code to authorize the Attorney General to intervene in private suits alleging sex discrimination in violation of the U.S. Constitution. Because such private suits could only be brought under 1983, the court read this provision to suggest that Congress believed 1983 suits for sex discrimination would continue. The court also noted that the case for displacement was especially weak in this case because the Title IX cause of action was not even one explicitly created by Congress. The Title IX cause of action was rather created by the Supreme Court in the 1979 case of Cannon v. University of Chicago. Title IX says only that institutions that discriminate on the basis of sex can lose their federal funding. Nonetheless, in Cannon, the court held that there is an implied private right of action for sex discrimination in Title IX. In Fitzgerald, the court noted that this implied right of action stood in stark contrast to the carefully tailored schemes that had been expressly created by Congress in the cases in the past where it had found displacement of the Section 1983 cause of action. And it is on this last point that I believe the Fitzgerald case will have its lasting significance. The Supreme Court has occasionally found implied private rights of action from spending clause legislation, but it had never before considered whether one of these implied rights of action could displace the express action under Section 1983. In my view, the Fitzgerald case will make it very difficult to argue in the future that any of these implied rights of action displace the 1983 cause of action. I say this because the court noted, first, that in one of its prior cases, it had suggested that displacement must be based on an express remedy. And of course, by definition, implied remedies are not express ones. Moreover, the court noted that it would be very difficult to discern whether Congress had intended to displace the 1983 cause of action when it wasn't even clear that Congress had created the implied cause of action in the first place. Thus, in my view, the most significant impact of Fitzgerald is its implication that Section 1983 suits will be found to coexist with all implied private rights of action. The fact that Title IX is only an implied right of action also gave this case what Chief Justice Roberts called at oral argument an air of unreality. The air of unreality, in my view, stems from the fact that many, and perhaps even a majority, of the current court probably do not believe that there should be any Title IX private right of action at all. This practice of finding implied rights of action had its heyday in the 1960s and 1970s. At that time, the court had a very ambitious view of the role that the court should play in finding remedies for rights. This practice has since fallen into disrepute, at least among conservatives, who have a much less ambitious vision for the Supreme Court. And as conservatives were added to the court in the 70s and 80s, the doctrine in favor of finding implied rights of action has been cut back. Indeed, I suspect that the conservative justices in Fitzgerald found themselves in the position of having to decide whether a cause of action, the Title IX cause of action, that they probably did not believe should exist in the first place, should be read either to duplicate another cause of action or to displace the other cause of action. By holding in favor of duplication, the conservatives permitted two causes of action to go forward where they probably believed only one should lie. But had they held in favor of displacement, they would have had to read a great deal more significance into a Title IX cause of action that they probably thought should not exist at all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.